This is an ABC podcast.
Roger Pulvers is an Australian writer who's lived four, maybe five, maybe six different lives across four different continents. Roger was born into an American Jewish family in the United States, and he had an all-American childhood. His parents even worked in the movie business. But Roger Pulvers was always looking over the horizon to somewhere else. As a young man, he studied literature in Russia and in Poland, but his scholarship was cut short in an international CIA scandal. Yes, then he made a new life in Japan, where he learned the language and fell in love with the culture, and he wrote books, plays, and films in Japanese. And then Roger reinvented himself once more when he came to Australia in the 1970s, and he walked away from his Americanness for good and became an Australian citizen. And this perplexed and infuriated his family, who had thought that coming to America was everything anyone could ever want. Hello, Roger.
Hello, Richard.
I just have to pick up your family story here, because it's just, in a way, your story is like a great coming to America story and then going away from America story in a lot of ways.
Yes, it is. Well, my four grandparents were born in Europe, but my parents were born in New York City, dad in 1903 and my mother in 1912. So, and my parents spoke only English. Dad spoke a little Yiddish, but only a little bit. But my father's parents were from the Pale of Settlement, and they were illiterate. So when in the mid-1890s, they arrived at Ellis Island in New York Harbor, which was the entry point for most migrants to the United States. Here was a man who was not only illiterate and spoke only Yiddish, but my grandfather had no legs below the knee.
Why did he have no legs below the
knee? Well, he was going to be conscripted into the Tsar's army, which was 25 years in the army, and Jews could not become officers. They could never rise above the rank of sergeant. So naturally, he made a wise decision, and that is hightail it out of there. The trouble was, it was winter, and the snow was very deep, and frostbite and set in, and he had to have his legs amputated below the knee.
Wow.
And he also had a withered left hand. So the amazing thing about the United States of America, which is very different from that country today, is he was an illiterate, disabled man who couldn't work, who had four children, a wife and four children, and his wife, my grandmother, was also illiterate. They both signed their name with a circle. You know, Jews didn't sign their name with an X. They signed with a circle, because an X is effectively a cross.
Oh,
so that,
right.
Because you write an X to say, I swear by the cross that this is me. But since Jews were not Christians, they signed with a circle. Be that as it may, America took them in. And so even though they had no prospects, they would have been, and they were a burden on the society. And they had four more children after that. So my dad was the eighth of nine children, born in a slum. He only finished primary school. And yet the grandson of that man, namely me, got a scholarship to Harvard and became an Australian author. So there you go. You have to have a long vision when you consider refugees and migrants. You don't just say, you go, you stay.
How about your mother? Tell me about her family story.
My mother's family was the exact opposite. My mother was from a very wealthy family. Her father was a diamond merchant, very wealthy. She grew up in Flatbush, which was then a very wealthy area of Brooklyn, in a big house. Cars, chauffeurs, governesses, and he went to Europe every summer. My grandfather did, but the Great Depression came in with the crash on Wall Street in October 1929, and he lost all of his money. And then he died of a heart attack, and my mother's family was left pretty destitute. And my mother, who was only 17 at the time, had to go out and work, and she became a legal secretary. The interesting thing is that my parents would never have met had it not been for the Depression, because they were from completely different social classes. So without the Depression, I wouldn't be here. So I bow down before Wall Street every morning thinking, thank you for this great crash, these tragedies. Of course, they cause great tragedies in many families, but they have occasionally have positive ripples down the line.
Tell me about when you did a bit of Googling into your mum's family history and about the great diamond heist that the family was involved in.
Well, I had heard about that, but the internet is wonderful. You can find out lots of things about your family. And my grandfather had set up this diamond business with two of his brothers. And one of the brothers, who ended up actually taking his own life some years later, unfortunately, because of this, went into on a train from New York to Chicago and put $150,000 at the time of diamonds, a bag underneath his pillow in his Pullman car. And when he woke up in the morning, it wasn't there.
So it's $150,000 worth of diamonds from, what, 100 years ago?
1923, right. That's right.
And so that will be worth, like, he was traveling across the country with millions of dollars worth of diamonds in a bag.
You've got to be crazy.
And did this make the news? This made the news, did it?
Yes, right. It did. Well, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yes,
well, if you said something, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, my God.
But no insurance.
Oh.
You know.
That makes my head spin thinking of that.
Well, I'm sorry, but that's you know, in everybody's family, there are things like that. So.
And then a few years later, there's the Great Depression, and everything's gone. All the family money is gone.
Basically, all of it gone in my grandfather's family. And my mother had to work. So she got a job for William S. Klein, who was the lawyer for the Schubert brothers, who were the owners of many theaters in New York. I mean, there were even Schubert theaters in. So she had a tie with show business from then. And then they met in 1938 at a dance and fell in love and got married.
So not long after you were born, the family pulled up sticks and went to Los Angeles. Why was that?
That's right. Well, they were actually living in Miami where my brother was born, and Dad was working as a bank teller in Miami, in Florida. And my mother hated Florida. It was hot. She didn't like the racism, the rednecks, you know. We're talking about Florida in the late 30s and early 40s. You can imagine what it was like. And she said, when she was pregnant with me and was going to give birth, she said, I'm not going to have my next baby in this state. And so she went back to New York, and I was born in Brooklyn. And then Dad didn't want to stay in New York, so... And she wouldn't go back to Florida. And in 1931, he had spent 6 months in Los Angeles and had loved it when he was single. So he said, let's go to L.A. So they took the train across the country and just went to L.A. And he got a job in a defense plant. And that's where I grew up, in Los Angeles.
How about your mom? What kind of work did your mom get?
She didn't work. I mean, women with small children didn't generally have jobs then. And she didn't go back to work until much later, after I had actually left home, and she became the personal secretary of Betty Davis.
Betty Davis's personal secretary.
Yes, who lived in West Hollywood, not far from where my parents lived.
Did she talk about that? She didn't talk
much about it, but she said when she got there at 10 in the morning, the first thing she did was mix a pitcher of vodka martinis for Betty Davis, who I assume was three sheets to the wind by early afternoon, but I don't know. That's a novelist speculation. And then she answered her letters. She did her correspondence.
Yeah. Sorry, honey, I got to go to work to make a pitcher of martini for Betty Davis. Wow, that's huge. Yeah. Were your parents drinkers? No. So they disapproved. They must have disapproved of this.
No, disapproved of alcohol.
So growing up as a nice Jewish boy in Los Angeles in the 1950s, what was expected of you, Roger?
Well, the holy trinity of Jewish careers for what you call nice Jewish boys is doctor, lawyer, certified public accountant, CPA, that you had to be one of those. I mean, the definition of a lawyer was a Jewish boy who couldn't stand the sight of blood. That's what the definition was. And I didn't want to be any of those. When I was on television as a 12-year-old, the announcer said, well, what do you want to be? And I said, I wanted to be a CPA. And he said, that's amazing. Do you know what that stands for? And I said, yes, certified public accountant. He said, do you know what a certified public accountant does? I said, no, but my mother told me that's what I want to be. So it was my first brush with the media. But
What went wrong?
The most amazing thing in October 1957. I don't know if that rings a bell with you, Richard, but when the Soviet Union launched the first artificial satellite called Sputnik.
Right. Mm.
Now, I wanted to be an astronomer when I was young, and I had telescopes, and I loved the stars, and that was my hobby. And one of the first times that Sputnik traversed this night sky over Los Angeles, I was out in the backyard watching it and seeing it. Now, this had an amazing impact on the United States of America. It was like the telephone or air travel. It was just unbelievable that there was an artificial satellite. And I went into the garage where my grandmother's old pre-war big, huge radio was, and I tuned into the channel where you could hear the beeps, and I heard this thing beeping. And the next day, I went to the public library, and I took out a dictionary of Russia, a Russian dictionary, and I started to teach myself Russian at age 13. And my parents' friends were appalled. You know, what is Roger, some sort of commie, is what my parents' friends said. And the relatives, of course, oy vey, you know, the worst anti-Semites in the world. What do you want to do that for, you know? So, I mean, I was mesmerized by the stars and by this achievement that, I mean, the Soviet Union wasn't supposed to. They were backward. They were communists. How could they do something that America couldn't do?
Yeah, but it flummoxed the United States. That did the launch of Sputnik. It really got the U.S. NASA space program.
Not only that, defense and education, and people started studying Russian. You know, and that, of course, later on, that's what I studied at university. But it was a big shock to the entire world, and good on them for doing that.
Now, you were a delegate, or invited to, invited to the Democratic National Convention, Party's National Convention in 1960.
Yes.
This was a legendary event.
It was the Biltmore Hotel.
John F. Kennedy was a candidate for the nomination, was Lyndon Johnson.
Hubert Humphrey.
Stuart Symington. A few other people as well. And you were there. Why were you there?
I was 16 years old, and I was asked to be head of youth for Symington. Now, Stuart Symington was a very interesting character. He was a senator from Missouri, which is considered a border state in the United States between the North and the South. Harry S. Truman, President Truman, who was also from Missouri, endorsed him and supported him. Truman hated the Kennedys.
Yeah, he hated them. Yeah.
And Symington had the steely good looks that people liked at the time, and he was a liberal. He made his name during the Army McCarthy hearings in the mid 50s when he put the final nails in the coffin of Joe McCarthy, who was this rabid alt-right sort of John Bolton type character, but he was a senator from Wisconsin. And so Symington was a kind of hero and was considered a sort of dark horse because Kennedy and Johnson were the two leading candidates for the nomination. And it was thought that if Kennedy didn't win on the first ballot, that perhaps the votes would have gone for Symington, or that Symington was going to become the vice presidential candidate.
He could have come up through the middle, couldn't he? Yeah, that was a possibility.
Right. Particularly if Kennedy had, even though Symington was born in Amherst, Massachusetts, he was originally from Massachusetts, but he was associated with the state that he represented in the Senate. So, but Kennedy won on the first ballot by, I think it was 52% or something, just a very small margin. So I saw Johnson. I met Symington, of course. I didn't do anything. For me, it was amazing. I mean, as I said, I was 16. I stood in the balcony and looked down on all these people with funny hats on and the balloons and everything. And I thought it was a convention of Bozo the Clown from all over the United States of America. And there they were. And then Bobby Kennedy was going around giving something to the delegates. And I said to this guy next to me, was an adult and involved in the convention, I said, what's Robert Kennedy giving to those people? He said, why, $100 bills? You know, so we know how, because Kennedy was not all that popular. And in fact, even after the nomination, there were a lot of people who thought Nixon was going to win. And Kennedy only won by a very small margin. I think it was a little over 100,000 votes. But of course, he won in the Electoral College.
I think your guy Symington was up against two of the most... Wily. Two men with with extremely wily politicians with brilliant machines behind them.
Particularly Johnson. Robert Kennedy was his brother's, you know, fixer, and also was much more, talking about wily, and much more, had much more political nous than Jack Kennedy did. And he was the one who persuaded his brother to make Johnson his vice president. You'd get it in those days, less so now. There needed to be kind of geographical balance, so Massachusetts and Texas, where Johnson was from, but also ideological. So, the South was still in the Democratic camp then. It was racist, but it was in the Democratic camp, so Johnson could bring the South to Kennedy, which, and he needed.
And he did.
And he did. Yeah. And so that was a very good appointment. But Jack Kennedy apparently was not in favor of Johnson, but Johnson had been apparently been given some racy photographs by J. Edgar Hoover of Jack Kennedy in flagrante delictu with a lot of women. And apparently he threatened to go public with these photographs if he wasn't made vice president. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a likely story, a real likely story.
So having seen Democracy in the Raw like
that's
that...
That's it, Democracy in America.
In the Raw, you know, I don't know who coined the phrase about, you know, if you don't watch sausages or democracy being made unless you've got a strong stomach. I think that's that old saying. So having seen that, then you went to Russia. You went to Russia.
Yeah.
Why did you want to go to Russia?
Well, I went to university before then. I went to UCLA, but I finished 4 years of undergraduate study in 3 years. And then I got a scholarship to Harvard Graduate School, to the Russian Research Center. And so I went to Boston. I was still 19 then, and just turning 20, actually. And I got a 2 years master's program, but I received the master's in 1 year. But between undergraduate and graduate, I traveled to the Soviet Union. It was my first time out of the United States of America. It was in the summer of 1964. I had just turned 20, and I spent 4 weeks traveling around the Soviet Union, which was an amazing eye-opener. Because if you think, World War II had ended only 19 years before then. Now, 19 years ago was like the year 2000. And the Soviet Union lost 25 or 26 million people in that war, more than all the other countries combined. And I had been taught in my American schools that we won the war against the Germans. America won the war. I didn't know. I mean, I knew from my studies of history that other countries had participated in, but I thought it was our victory. But the Russians thought of it much, and with much greater legitimacy, as their victory. So, for instance, 70% of the German soldiers in the Wehrmacht, in the army, who died in World War II are now buried within the confines, the borders of this old Soviet Union. It's very clear who took the brunt of the German attack. It was the Russians. It was the Soviet. It was the people of the Soviet Union.
Still at the time you were there, this was the fag end of the Khrushchev years, I would have been.
Khrushchev was in power, for another few months. He was deposed a couple of months after that. And people were extremely nice to me. Really, I thought, why are these people my enemy? Now, I had very little sympathy with communism, and I knew that there was very little freedom, and they were so ill-informed. I mean, one guy said, how many bricks are there in the Empire State Building? You know, we want to know that, you know. And I said, I don't know. I don't even think it's made of bricks. But I mean, yet they were very friendly. And I thought, well, why should these people be my enemy? And I fell in love with Russian culture, Russian poetry, the Russian language. And so then I went to Harvard and did my master's. And then in 1965, summer of 65, I spent another 4 weeks traveling, hitchhiking and traveling around the Soviet Union by myself. And then in 1966, I went to Poland, to Warsaw University, to do a postgraduate.
So this whole time you've been going across the Iron Curtain, what was the Iron Curtain
well,
those
yeah,
days?
Well, yeah, that's right.
To go and study in these places. What went wrong with your scholarship that you had to Poland?
Well, I received a scholarship from the National Student Association of the United States. They had an exchange with Poland. And I went to Poland thinking that the National Student Association, which was a national organization representing student bodies across the United States of America, tertiary institutions, educational institutions. And I didn't know, but found out subsequently, that the NSA was funded by the CIA. After all, it was against the war in Vietnam, but the CIA supports, as a lot of intelligence organizations do around the world, they support the other side quite often so that they can pull the rug out from under them whenever they want.
And keep an eye on it too,
and keep an eye on it and do espionage and so on.
So your scholarship was essentially funded by a CIA front?
At the end of January in 1967, I got a call from the head of the NSA. He said, come to London, we want to talk to you. So I left all my stuff in Poland and I went to London and I was taken to the American embassy. It was a Sunday morning and there was this guy in his gray flannel suit and Sunday, everything else was closed. And he said, there's a magazine called Ramparts Magazine, which next week is going to come out with an article that says that the NSA is funded by the CIA. I said, of course it isn't. Why? We're a liberal organization. And he said, of course it's not. Oh, yeah, thanks a lot. You know, give me a break. And he said, we didn't want you in Poland when it came out. So why don't you go to France where your girlfriend is? I said, how do you know about that? You know. So I went to France and then it broke, and it broke very big. My photograph was on the front page of the Los Angeles Times, you know, local boy lost in Europe. My dad said, my son does not work for the CIA, but if he did, I'd be proud of him because the CIA isn't a doity void with me. That's what he said.
And are you reading this in the paper? Son,
yes. Right, I read it in the paper. I've still got the clippings. And my mother said, my son is not a spy. He likes sport and girls.
But having gone there all that time, you must have been approached. Were you a bit naive?
I was a goody two shoes. I thought we could all be friends. I swear to God, I had no idea about this.
But while you're doing this marvelous tour around the Soviet Union, you would have been followed by KGB agents
and
kept an eye on very closely.
Oh, absolutely.
Did they approach you? No one approached you?
CIA approached me in the US later on, but that's another story. Right. That's a long story. But that was later on, and I told them to. Well, I won't say use expletives on a nice radio program like this. But I was in a cafe having an espresso in Paris, and I was reading Le Monde, an article about me that I was presently in Washington, D.C. being debriefed. And talk about, like Sputnik, Richard.
What?
Talk about, it's fake news.
Yeah.
But talking about important incidents in one's life, I thought, because I was getting a bit neurotic. I mean, I was at sea. I was 23 years old. My whole life had collapsed as I saw it. And I thought, well, maybe I am in Washington, D.C. And you know how you think, just for a minute, maybe, who am I? And I began to just have flashes of like an identity crisis. And that is, I later on wrote plays and worked in the theater. And I attribute the ability to write plays to that you begin to think, who am I? Am I really myself? And when someone accuses you of something, like you're a spy, aren't you? How do you prove you're not? You know, and that became one of the themes, not necessarily spying, but people searching for themselves and so on. It didn't last very long.
So when a government asks you, which it was doing in that case, not directly, but when a government asks you not to believe your lying eyes, when it says, you're reading this in Paris, and the government's saying, this guy's not in Paris.
No.
He's in Washington. And you go, am I in Washington?
That's right, yeah.
So who is in Washington? Who is here in Paris?
Who's
here in Paris?
Yeah, who's me? Yeah, and what am I? So what is my life? I mean, as I said, I was very young. I was extremely naive. I thought everybody was nice and, you know, people really didn't do evil things to other people. And I went back to the U.S. because my French girlfriend broke up with me, so I couldn't go back to France and I couldn't go back to Poland. I thought I'd end up in jail, which I ended up going back in 1970 and didn't go to jail at all and had a wonderful time. So the Poles knew I wasn't a spy. So I went back to the U.S. and we're talking the northern summer of 1967, where tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of American troops are being sent to Vietnam. And I was about to be drafted. And I thought, because I lost my student deferment, and I thought, what can I do? So I took a plane to Tokyo, and I arrived in September 1967 without a word of Japanese, $300 in my pocket, one suitcase, and I thought, I'm going to reinvent myself here. And from the first day, I thought, this is my country. I love Japan. I want to be Japanese.
Do you remember why you chose Japan? Was it because it was so radically different?
I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know. I can tell you why I ate ramen yesterday or why I saw a movie instead of going to a play. But the big questions are, that we ask ourselves of why we go somewhere, why we change jobs, and so we rationalize it later. I can tell you now why it was the right decision. It brought me to Australia. I turned into an author and a filmmaker, so that's wonderful. I don't think that would have happened had I stayed in the United States. I would have been a certified public accountant, probably, and a very disgruntled one, and a very bad one, you know. But
was it because Japan is like none of the above in a way? Like you say, is it the East, or you know, is it the United States, or is it the Soviet bloc?
Well, it's it was none another place to go. I didn't know anybody, but very, very luckily, through an introduction of a friend, I met a professor and I was offered a job teaching Russian and Polish in a Japanese university, a lectureship with tenure, and they said, you have to learn Japanese. So in 6 weeks, I learned Japanese.
I have to ask you, were you trying to kill your parents? Were you trying to kill your parents by doing this, Roger? You're going to come home.
You know,
we bring you up to, we come to America. We give you this beautiful childhood, this beautiful standard of living. Are you trying to kill us?
Yes, no, they didn't say that. But the big thing was, why would you want to live anywhere else? It's fine. Go have a good time. You know, eat the ramen. Do whatever you want. But come back, you know. And why would anybody want to leave? I mean, Americans think that if you've been to America, it's like seeing God and then claiming you're an atheist. You know, why would anybody want to do that? You couldn't do that. Everybody wanted to be an American in those years.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Once you got to Japan, to Kyoto, why did you respond so quickly and strong? I mean, many of us do when we go there for the first time. It's a very powerful place. But what did you love about the place so quickly?
I just felt so much at home in Japan, even though people said you'll never be accepted. You're a gaijin, which is a foreigner. And I said, no, I don't. If you want to treat me differently, you go ahead. It doesn't bother me, because it never bothers. One is what one is, and that's all you can do. But I took to Japanese culture. I discovered an author who's not that well known outside of Japan, but is a god in Japan, Miyazawa Kenji. And very early on, I started reading Kenji's work. Kenji is his given name, but he's referred in Japan to by his given name. And I subsequently translated him. I have a book out in Great Britain called Strong in the Rain, which is a book of his poetry. But in 1968, I went up north, about 500 kilometers north of Tokyo in Tohoku, in the area that was hit by the tsunami. There's a little town called Hanamaki, which is 90 kilometers from the coast, so it was unaffected by the tsunami. And I went to look into who he was, and he died in 1933 at the age of 37. But I went to his house, and there was outside the nameplate said Miyazawa, and I went, stood under the eaves, and I said, Gomen kudasai, which is excuse me. And his brother came out, who was in his mid-60s.
So you don't knock on the door there, do you?
No, you don't knock, generally don't know. You can do ping pong, ring the bell, but you generally don't knock on, in the old-fashioned sliding doors. First of all, it can be glass.
Yeah, you put your hand through it, right. You stand there and cry out, do you?
Well, you can do that, but I just felt that was the right thing to do.
And once you had done
and
that,
the 64-year-old younger brother, who was 29 when Kenji died, came out, and it was the year that Kawabata Yasunari received the Nobel Prize, was to receive a few months later, the Nobel Prize for Literature, the first Japanese. So Kawabata, Mishima, Tanizaki, these were the famous authors who were studied in the American mostly in the American and foreign universities. But I was lucky. I never studied Japanese. So I didn't have any prejudices to who was the greatest author. I discovered Kenji. And later on, of course, I read all the others as well. And I said to him, I'm from America in Japanese, but I love Miyazawa Kenji. He went, oh, like that. So he sort of welcomed me into his family. 3 weeks ago, I was back up there with his grandson, who's now in his late 50s. And I'm a sort of part of the Miyazawa family.
Right. So you brought into the poet's family there.
Yeah. Right. Oh, his brother and the other relatives. And I started translating his work, and he is like, who is he like? He's a combination of Lewis Carroll and Walt Whitman. His poetry is very beautiful, but very lyrical, and also about human nature, about empathy. Of course, it's different from Whitman. Did I say Walt Whitman?
You did. No, you didn't. You said Walt Whitman.
That's live radio.
That's right. Easily confused.
We'll get on to Whitman in a minute. He's often considered a children's author because his stories are often about children. But he's just the most wonderful author. And he was a vegetarian. He wrote about animal cruelty in the 1920s. He was into renewable energy. So he's being rediscovered as a kind of guru of the 21st century. And I just started translating him. And then I started writing my own short stories. And I published my first book of short stories in English in Japan in 1969. And then I started writing plays. But I couldn't get my plays on, and an offer came at the end of 1971 from the Australian National University in Canberra, Australia, where I'd never been and never thought of going, because to the American left, Australia was considered a racist backwater, which was not all that untrue. The White Australia policy was still in force. And Harold Holt had said all the way with LBJ, so he didn't endear himself to us by doing that. And I thought, well, if I go to this place called Australia, maybe I'll be able to become a playwright and write books. And if I didn't like it, I could turn around and come back to Japan. So in August 14th, 1972, when McMahon was still prime minister of this country, I arrived in Canberra and I looked up at the sky. Because the stars in any city, I always knew the stars. I always knew at least what latitude I was at, standing at. And I didn't recognize half of them. And Orion was standing on its head.
Upside down.
Yeah. Mm. And I thought, oh, my God, where have I come? And there were Rosellas flying around and leaf's curling spiders and the weird animals and plants. And I thought, this is just the most amazing place that I've come to. And I loved it. And then in December of that year, who became my hero, was elected prime minister and brought the conscientious objectors out of jail and started, Jim Cairns, who was deputy prime minister. You might be a little bit too young, Richard, to remember this, but he denounced Nixon as a maniac when Nixon was bombing North Vietnam, and I thought this is a great country. And in August 1973, I had translated a play from Polish by a Polish playwright named Witkiewicz, greatest Polish playwright of the 20th century, who was here in 1914. That's another story. And wrote a play about Australia, the only play written about Australia by a major European playwright. And I translated, and the Alice Springs Theatre Company decided to put it on. So I got a travel grant from the then Australia Council for the Arts, is what it was called, to travel to the Red Centre. So I flew through Adelaide from Canberra, and I went to, or Melbourne, and I went to Alice Springs and saw the play, and I was blown away by what the atmosphere and the nature. But I went to Uluru, and it was the 100th anniversary of the, in inverted commas, discovery of what was then called Ayers Rock. Mm. And I thought, I thought it would have been discovered before, 100 years earlier.
I think people were aware of it for a while before that.
I would assume so. Yeah. And there were celebrations all around. There was an old pub, which has long been torn down, right by Uluru. And I didn't climb it. I've been there since as well, and neither time have I climbed, but I walked around it, and you could get in. In those days, there was no fence around it. You could go in and into the caves. And I just thought this was the most spiritual, amazing place I had ever been to in my life. Better than the Grand Canyon, better than any. I just felt these vibes coming from this rock. And when I got back to Canberra, my sand shoes, my white sand shoes, had turned red, ochre color, from the dust. So I threw them into the washing machine, and when I took them out, they were still red. And here's another one of those miraculous moments in one's life. I thought, well, maybe I've been dyed too by the soil of Australia. I really did think, we novelists, we think in metaphors. And I thought, well, maybe I'm going to be an Australian. Maybe I'm going to stay here. And then on the day of the dismissal in November 1974, was it?
Five,
1975. You're right, of course, 1975. I was at home listening to the radio, and I was so incensed that someone had done this to this great prime minister. The next day, I went down to the Bureau of Immigration, and I applied for Australian citizenship. And you couldn't have dual citizenship in those days, and I didn't want it anyway. And on July 6th, 1976, 2 days after the 200th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, so it was kind of I received my citizenship papers, and I ceased to be an American, and I became an Australian.
This is an interesting reaction to the dismissal, because I remember the Australian author Xavier Herbert at the time said, I always knew Australia was a country of bastards, those lines. He was angered. He felt in a way he wanted to almost disavow Australia.
I'm still maintaining the rage right now.
You had the exact opposite reaction. You said, I want to sign up.
I want to sign up. I thought, I care so much. And, you know, I was on the steps of Old Parliament House with my poster, you know, and and my poster was Kemlani votes Liberal. Now, many older people would remember the shady Pakistani wheeler dealer who came back to Australia with two empty suitcases, you know, and the Liberal Country Party at the time said that this had incriminated. It was like the fake emails, you know, Hillary Clinton's email, that they had something on the Labour Party, you know. And so I felt so... because, Richard, I had left the United States without protesting the war in Vietnam. I was, as I said earlier, I was the goody two-shoes. I wanted to be a senator, or, you know, I wanted to be a good American. And then the war in Vietnam and seeing the other side, not in a positive light, but that our enemies were very nice people and we shouldn't kill them just because, for some political reasons. And so... maybe I was making up for what I hadn't done in the United States. I was at an older age, and yet I still wasn't an Australian citizen. I felt I really identified with this country, and it was an amazing time to be in Australian culture with the theatre.
Yes, there was a lot going on. Well, that's another thing. It strikes me that when you've gone from place to place, each place you've been to while you've been there has been going through this great kind of cultural moment.
You can say
that was true in Poland in the mid-60s. There was amazing cinema coming out of Poland at the time.
Exactly.
Then you're in Japan in those years when there's all that literature coming out.
And Russia, when Khrushchev was deposed the year before and the year after, was very big change for the Soviet Union.
And then you're here in the 70s, which was going through that major cultural... The 60s arrived in Australia
That's
in the 70s, as people often say.
That's
so
right.
You've seen all these times. But nonetheless, you said you couldn't get the red stain from Uluru out of your sneakers.
I couldn't. No, I became an... But on the other hand, because of my accent, you know, even a couple of weeks ago, I was in Canberra and I was at a department store and the lady, I was at the cash register, said, "Where are you from?" I said, "I'm Australian." She said, "You don't sound Australian." I leaned over the counter and I said in a very nice voice, "What does an Australian sound like? Can you please tell me?" And she thought, "Oh yeah, that's right." You know, I mean, we are the most diverse... pleasantly diverse. Of course, America goes far further back and has more people of each ethnicity. But when we come here, when we become Australians, we carry some of the nicest parts of our nationality and our ethnicity, I'd like to think, and we still have civility towards each other, which the United States has lost this sense of decorum, that we can still have a dialogue with people who are different from us. And I've just spent 10 months living in London. I came back in April, and it was like doing a homestay in a family where there's a divorce. I mean, people are not talking to each other. There's no more dialogue. It's all finger pointing and name calling. And luckily, we're not like that. I'd like in yet. Parentheses
yeah.
yet
yeah.
in this country. I and let's never. Not go there.
Mm. So to become Australian, as you said, we didn't have dual citizenship in those days.
No.
That meant you had to relinquish your American passport.
I did. Oh,
passport.
Yes.
I'm sorry to do this, but I'm going to keep bringing up your mother and father here, your parents. What did this do to your parents?
They were appalled. It almost caused a rift as big as the Ritz between us. It was just, talk about the Grand Canyon, you know.
Did they accept it? Were they in denial? Or what?
I went back to Dad's 75th birthday for the first time in 11 years. I went back to Los Angeles in December 1978. And I noticed that they had an album. Because in the 70s, I wrote for the Canberra Times, the National Times. I did plays. I did radio shows that were reviewed. I had interviews. And I always sent back clippings, you know, as one does to one's parents. I wanted them to be proud of me and to know what I was doing. All children, I have four children of my own. And of course, they want their parents to know what they're doing. We're all like that. And so I looked at this album, but it was full of places where there were black marks put in by a marker pen, a magic pen, you know. So it said, black mark playwright Roger Pulvers, like second rate or no goodnik playwright or something like that. So I looked at it and I couldn't figure out what it was. And Dad's best friend was visiting at the time and said, Roger, what's all these black marks before your name? And I realized it said Australian before. So they had crossed it out from the, and so there was. I tell you,
that's terrible.
There was a pregnant pause in my home, as like you've never heard before. And so finally, my mother, bless her heart, she said, "Well, Roger's bought a house down there." So my father's friend said, "Oh, if you've bought a house, because if you have units, you know, or your real estate, then of course you become a citizen." So they. But my parents never really accept. They came here. They loved it in Australia.
All right, they liked it here. So then they got here.
Oh yeah. Oh no, they were liberal minded people. Always thanks to FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and what he did for the United States, they wouldn't dare vote for a Republican, and they. So I grew up in a liberal household, but they were dyed-in-the-wool Americans. They couldn't see past the borders of the United States, as many people, not only in America, but in other countries as well, feel.
So they could come to accept you choosing Australianness because it's just like that's a property thing. It's not a
no. That was my father's
it's not a principal
friend.
Thing, right? All right,
I don't know that they ever really accepted it. They weren't happy about that because it also meant that I wasn't going to come home ever. And I think...
Oh, that would be hard on them. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think so. But each child has to have their own fate and their own destiny. And you can't, you know, I mean, parents die and the child grows up and lives out the life. Why would you want to live your life as a CPA, you know, if you're not the CPA in Australia is the Communist Party of Australia. So it's very different. But if that's not what is in your nature... Just because we're somebody's child, it doesn't mean that we're somebody's property.
Adjusting to the Australian sense of humor is often tricky for people from the United States.
It is.
And how about your parents?
No. They couldn't understand Australian humor. I took them to... I was living in Melbourne. I was working at the Playbox Theatre as director and playwright in residence. And Melbourne in the early 80s had a great theatre restaurant
the last
scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, The Last Laugh.
Yeah.
Of course. You remember the Flying Trapeze. Yeah, there were great places. So I took them to The Last Laugh, and everybody was cracking up at the show, and my parents had this very sober, straight face, poker face on them. And Dad said, "It's not funny, because something that isn't funny to Americans just isn't funny." But, well, God bless them, Richard.
Was he joking?
No, he isn't because
it's not funny to an American. It's not funny.
Yeah. I'm sorry, but you know, I think a lot of people in the United States, I don't know whether that's typical or not, but I mean, that's the way they were. All right. But they ended up, you know, I think resigning themselves to. Yeah.
So this is a bit of a side trip here, but you've been involved as an author with film and film production as well, and this meant you got to work alongside and with David Bowie for a period of time.
Yeah, 7 weeks, every day. Morning to night. Yeah.
Right, and that was during the making of Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence.
That's right. I was assistant director on Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, which we shot on Rarotonga in the Cook Islands and in Auckland in September and of August and September 1982.
Now, you see, I've heard a lot of stories of that Bowie was actually, you know, aside from being the extraordinary artist that he was actually a lovely human being. Please don't disillusion me on this.
No, he was the nicest. David Jones was his name.
Yes, and, yeah, yes.
And he was the nicest, most unpretentious, sweetest guy.
Did you become friends?
We became very close friends. I only saw him once or twice after that, so it wasn't as if he sort of took to me and thought he wanted me to be his friend. I'm not making pretenses about that. But while we were working with him, I was very close friends with him and very nice. And we used to go have drinks, just the two of us, one night, around sunset. We had finished the shoot early and we were on the beach at Rarotonga having a martini or gin and tonic or something like that. And the sunset was beautiful and we were chatting when this lovely young woman came by and she stopped short. She stopped dead in her tracks. She looked at us and she said, "Oh my God, I don't believe it. I can't believe it." And David started to stand up. She said, "Roger Pulvers." So that was definitely the best moment of my life. It should happen to you, Richard, not to be repeated. And David was half standing and he turned to me and said, "This is wonderful. This is marvelous." It had never happened to him either. So. But he loved being on Rarotonga because he wasn't recognized there. So he could walk around without his bodyguards. Whereas when we got to Auckland, he went into a different hotel and
there's a whole other thing.
I didn't see very much of him except on the set in Auckland.
Like I said at the start, in some ways your life story is a kind of a coming to America story, then going away from America story, having lived all over the world as you have. Over the years on this program, there have been people who have articulated two different views of human nature. And one is that we're born nomads. Yeah. That's what's in our DNA. We need to accept that and give ourselves over to that and be ready to travel, be ready to move on to another place and move on to another place.
Right.
Another theory of human nature says that we need our roots. We are absolutely grounded. We grow up amongst a certain series, a certain kind of nature, a certain kind of bird song, a certain kind of environment. And if we break away from that, we lose something of ourselves with each move that we make. I just wonder if you have a thought on that or a theory about that.
Well,
yourself.
I think we're both. And in my book, The Unmaking of an American, one of the chapters is The American in Me. And I don't deny that there's, even though I haven't lived in the United States for over 50 years, there's still a lot of America that was inculcated in the best sense and in the worst sense in me that I have, that I don't reject. I don't say I hate that place. Like a lot of migrants, refugees, never go back. Well, you know, terrible place. I don't feel that at all. I don't want to go back. I'd never live there for all the tea in China. But it is in me. But we have a kind of wanderlust as well. There's an expression in Japanese, Ishibashi o tataite wataru. It means you should cross the stone bridge only after you've tapped it to make sure that it's, in other words, to make sure that it's, look before you leap is the English expression. Make sure that it's solid before you go over it. But I don't have that quite so much in my nature. I think you should go across a stone bridge without wasting the time to tap on it. If you end up in the water, as I did with my spy scandal when I was framed, you just swim to the shore and, you know, dry yourself off and stand up and go on. But I think life presents times of change and risk and where you choose, well, I have a lot of nice things happening now, and I don't know what's on the other side, but I'm just going to go over there and have a look and test myself over there to see what kind of person I can become. And I think That's in a lot of us, and some of us stop and say, no, no, I'm not sure. It's pretty good here. I'll stay here. So I think, I don't know if that answers your question, but I think we have both currents in us, and it just depends which we give a voice to and which we follow in our life.
Nostalgia is something that's like a, it's a very dangerously intoxicating thing, and it's really best only consumed in the tiniest amounts. That's my view in any case. Do you think, having led the life you have...
and still leading it, I hope.
And still leading, indeed, yes. That you need to push nostalgia to one side or not imbibe, or do you like nostalgia? What do you do with that?
Constantly. Oh, yeah, I'm really nostalgic and sentimental for the past. I go back to a place and I remember, because the neurons get all stirred up and I remember things I hadn't thought of before, which is important in an author. You need to rely on your memories and so as a jumping off point, and you change them, of course. But I'm constantly, I read voraciously, I'm constantly trying to go to new places and I'm turned 75 this year, but have to think about what I'm going to do for the next 50 years and my life.
And when you go back to Japan, do you go back to being Japanese Roger?
What does that mean?
I mean it's like
myself. Yeah,
yeah, you are yourself, but you show a different side of yourself, maybe?
I don't think so. I really don't think so. I think we're all ourselves in whatever language we speak, but of course you express yourself in different ways. You're not using English, you're using Japanese, and I give lots of public lectures in Japan, and I still tell Jewish jokes in the beginning, you know, and get a good response to them. So I don't know that one is changed, but I think that's for other people to decide. Going back to that moment in the cafe in Paris, I don't know if we can really accurately look at ourselves and say, this is me. I think it's for other people to decide.
Looking upon that moment, that cafe in Paris where you said, well, who am I after all? Yeah. You said you see that now as a great blessing.
It is. It is a blessing, yeah.
It's a way of seeing yourself in a completely different way that you'll forever be grateful to then.
That's right.
Roger, that's an amazing story, and I've really enjoyed speaking with
you. Me too.
Thank you so much, Roger.
I'm delighted. Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Langoth Black Mountain. Armadural.
Yeah, so,
yeah, you get that double look, like, really?
One night they just kick the door down.
I only get to Walcha by 5 p.m.
I'm trying to flush the heroin down the loo.
It looks, in some ways it looks like a light bulb with a little antenna. In other ways it looks kind of like, it looks like a sex toy.
From hunting for thylacines in the Tasmanian wilderness.
It's a quadruped, stocky. It's got the right shaped ears.
To chasing a Russian spy through Sydney streets.
And then Sergei pulled out a $50 bill and then dropped his trousers.
From an avalanche to an addiction.
You're literally hearing the sound of two pieces of the planet shifting against each other.
And a mad dash down the coast in some of the worst floods in living memory.
One night in Tamworth, up at 5 a.m.
Wallop at dark muscles.
You will find laughs, you will find danger. These are real Australian stories, and everyone comes with a little twist.
I go, yeah, I'm just going to buy a one-way ticket.
Just search for Days Like These in your favourite podcast app.
And, yeah, that's a vision that you're not going to get out of your mind anytime soon.
So join me, Elizabeth Koolass, for more stories about the moment when everything changes.